first entertain you with some movies. I also put the Michael Beatles in parentheses because I probably won't have time to say much about that. So that's the movie that I've seen a little bit of before that shows the formation of the first Via Lattea halo in physical coordinates. So the colors are given by the projected dark matter density square, its physical density, and also the positions are physical. So you see the bubble expansion at the beginning, and the inner parts quickly turn around and form this halo in a series of matrix mergers, which finishes about now. And now the overall mass distribution is relatively stable, and there's just lots of smaller things falling in and out of the system.
Is that
well? You see some kind of like fans of particles that spray away from the subhalos once they go through pericenter.
I'm just wondering, with the weighting, is this more or less representative of what you would see in annihilation?
That's exactly what you would see in annihilation. Yeah, it's projected density squared.
Okay, so fine. So you see them there.
Where are you seeing cosplays?
Well, if he reruns the movie again, you saw lots of cosplays.
Like balloons.
Yeah, they're sharp edges.
Okay,
I mean, if you did edge detection with a circular.
Yeah, maybe when this big guy comes in, you might see one. Well, you can look for the same thing in this movie, too. That's essentially the same. Now, I have added an inset that shows the evolution of this thing here. It starts at 2 now. That's about the time when this halo falls in. That's one that's going to lose a lot of mass, but from the outside, there, okay, the mass that's removed. Yeah, you see some kind of like shells that sprays of material that goes away from the.
I mean, you can maybe another way of putting it is you can see where the turnaround radius is at any given time, right?
Yeah.
But there's a discontinuity in the density of the turnaround radius.
Okay, so that's a system that has suffered a lot of, that's lost about 99% of its mass. Its inner density is still pretty much intact. It's also become a little bit rounder over this evolution, which is quite typical. I forgot to mention it, but this arrow always pointed towards the galactic center, and for a good fraction of its orbit, this thing points with its major axis towards the galactic center by some kind of tidal alignment. And if you look at all the redshift zero subhalos, you find a statistically significant signal that they tend to be aligned towards the galactic center, which has two obvious implications. When you look at annihilation signals from subhalos, many of them are somewhere in the upper halo, so we pick up more or less the radial direction when we observe them from atrial parsecs, so that makes them a little bit brighter. Also, when you look at the velocity dispersions of dwarfs, faint dwarfs, we often tend to see relatively radial, we look at them relatively close to the radial direction towards the galactic center. So it's not just the triaxial potential of these things does not just introduce a scatter, it also introduces a slight upwards bias. So we tend to see the hottest direction of many of these systems, if that is true for the dwarf elliptical that sits inside these triaxial potentials. The color scale goes over, I think, about 12 orders of magnitude. It's huge. Of course, the galactic center is always by far the. Yes.
Pointing at. I mean, these are features probably at like 10 to the minus 8 times less luminous than.
Yeah, they were not that bright yellow that you had in the centers of subhalos. They were far below that.
I saw the maps earlier that I showed there was no features visible in those. Right. That's all the particles.
They're visible in that movie, but it would be pretty hard to see them better.
Yeah, I mean, I showed actually from some density square.
This is just an illustration for what the histories could look like for the possible hosts of the 10 classical dwarfs. These are 10 largest systems before efficient volume. The ones that are actually shown are the 10 early forming systems. You have a wide range of different orbits. You have some that are just falling in today, others have made 1 percenters, and others have made 11 percenters. So that's like this one is repeated very early. There's also some correlation that the ones which are in the inner galaxy today tend to be the ones which made a lot of orbits on average. Mm. But it's not one to one because orbits are very radial. And then the same history is in terms of tidal mass and in terms of peak circle velocity. In both panels, you see typically quite drastic reduction at the first pericenter, and then it often slows down so that mass becomes smaller over time. Except for the biggest systems like this is brownish one, it's hard to see, which is so heavy that its orbit decays rapidly by the friction. So this one loses a lot of mass all the time. And in this panel, I show our concentration index, which just measures the density within the peak circle velocity scale. And removing the outer low density parts moves this scale further in, so this measure of concentration goes up during the time of stripping.
So Vmax is the peak velocity, and you actually see these things rebounding after pericentric passage. Is that what those little blips are?
Yeah.
So that's also
like quick compression and the rebound after pericentric.
I guess it's not a huge effect, but it's also kind of interesting that the observed dwarfs. I never thought about that. But if the stars are doing the same thing, then you're actually the velocities are slightly dependent on where
it's essentially the same here, but that's not in Vmax, it's in tidal mass. So the red line would be a tidal mass graph like we've seen before. And that's now for one example that has this 1 percenter passage, a relatively large radius, 50 kiloparsecs. The red line is that at each instant the mass within the tidal radius. And then the black lines are masses within a fixed scale. So that illustrates the point that was mentioned by Andrew in the morning, that for tidal stripping is not instantaneous. At pericenter, the tidal radius of that mass become very small, but the mass outside of that radius is not just gone. That a lot of it is still there. So when you go away from the center again, you see that the tidal mass actually goes up again. So instead of just removing everything, you can just add in a little delay as you all of you have in your models, and then you can kind of recover the right final mass again.
So can I ask a question? So these top halos, do they asymptotically lose all their mass, or would they have a fraction of their mass left?
So that there's sort of an inner part that's pretty unaffected by the stripping in the outer region. But this point sort of marks the transition from where the stripping is effective to where it's not doing much at all. And that's the point where the duration of this tidal shock during the impact center is equal to the internal elemental time of the system. So this inner part will just do a couple of orbits during that same time scale, but they're protected against this. So this is a slightly more extreme example. That thing goes much further in. It has 3 pericenters. And I show in this panel the second one of the three, which is it's within 10 kiloparsecs. So now the tidal mass instantaneously goes very far down, but again, the mass is not removed, so it comes back up. And even in this case, you have an inner part which is more or less protected, although it's so far in that it's not so well resolved anymore. So I kind of don't have more lines in here to prove that not much happens further in because they run out of particles. And that's a system where the tidal radius actually becomes much smaller than the scale radius at pericenter. And it was suggested that all these systems should be completely destroyed. I mean, but they're not. I mean, they lose a lot of mass, but we can trace this system back out to upper center and to an even closer pericenter in the future, and it still survives. So there's an inner part that tends to survive all the time if you have enough particles there. If we look at all the well-resolved substructures at redshift 1 and trace them forward, we find practically for all of them a distinct surviving remnant. So 97% of them do survive. a small percentage of them merge with other subhalos. That percentage is small just because it's, the environment is too hot for them to find each other and to merge. We can also look at how much of the mass they keep from redshift 1 to redshift 0. And it turns out to be a function of the initial size, so measured in terms of their initial peak circle velocity scale. And it's quite clear that these very large things are losing that much mass because their orbits are decaying quickly. So they're really going very close to the center, and they're eventually completely destroyed. These things here only, they keep almost 40% of their mass from redshift 1 to 0. And things that are smaller than about 8 kilometers per second lose more mass again, which is about also the scale where our velocity function becomes incomplete due to numerical limitations in this first Wheel-Lockyer simulation. So the question is, how would that continue to very, very small scales? Obviously, it's got to have to, that has to flatten off somehow. It's probably going to become constant once the damp friction is completely unimportant. When it's going to asymptote to some value between a half and or a bit larger. Now about the evolution of the main halo, the host halo mass distribution. I want to compare it with very simple classical models. The first very basic one is just a spherical top hat collapse. So you have an overdensity, expands, turns around, and would in principle go back all the way to zero. But then what one does is one assumes that there's no kinetic energy at all here, and that after the collapse, it has to fulfill the Weyl theorem that gives you a collapse factor of exactly 2. So you'd say at this point, the thing is realized, and this mass ends up within this radius. So that's the real radius at this time. And that turns out to be at the radius of 187 above the critical density for an EDS universe, and slightly higher for lambda CDM redshift 0 and redshift dependent. So now we looked at what these shells actually, how they evolve. So these are shells containing a fixed mass. Just to focus on this one, this is the mass like M200 close to the real mass at redshift 0. Now this shell, according to the model, should have collapsed by a factor of 2. So it should have gone up all the way to 0.8 megaparsecs and then fallen back to 400 kiloparsecs. But it did collapse by a much smaller fraction. That's 200 above the mean. So the actual real radius would be about 100 above the mean. So that would be a slightly smaller scale, but it would be the same picture. So it's aligned somewhere here between. So that it doesn't collapse nowhere close to factor 2 as it's supposed to be in the very simple plastic model. Mm-hmm. And of course, these shells are not really the branch of shells either. They just contain the same mass at all times, but not the same particles.
So you're saying that the Weyl radius is not half turnaround, is that right? It's more than half turnaround.
Yes. Okay.
Are you saying the greedy mass?
Yeah, I'll explain that a bit more now. So it's also been pointed out in this paper that if you look at the stationary mass around galaxies or the mass that's in equilibrium, that region does not end at the Weyl radius. That goes up to about 2 Weyl radii. And if you look at how the mass, if you compare like mass within fixed physical radii, with these black lines, if you compare that to the evolution of Weyl radius, which is the red one, or with the evolution of M200, they're kind of different. But early on, everything grows quickly. That's the phase where there's a lot of merging and a lot of physical accretion. There's really most coming in at these times. And then there's times where practically nothing happens. All the black lines are horizontal. And there's a minor merger here that brings in another 10% of the mass, and then it's again horizontal. What's often called mass accretion history is the red line. And that's measuring something a bit different. It's measuring something like M200. It's just, by definition, it's always going to increase because the universal background density goes down. And so if you want to say, in economic terms, it's like having a nominal growth in the virial mass, but there's no real growth, at least in these two periods from here to here. Another thing that I should point out that's, of course, different from this just smooth spherical collapse is practically all of the mass that ends up in the system is accounted for if you sum up the masses of the concentrics. So there's no clear evidence for smooth.
So can I ask you something? So isn't it true that the concentration is supposed to go down when you have measures? So then shouldn't the mass, is that true? Yeah.
The concentration is low here. Yeah, in this space, it's like the usual concentration just that measures how much smaller the scale radius is relative to this some other fish viral radius. This is always small in this early phase when the system is forming.
And then the
scale radius is remaining constant, and the viral radius goes up. So that means concentration is going up from the time where the formation is actually gone, more or less finished, until today. It's roughly proportional to.
So there is no major measure after that point?
After that point, no.
So the blue things, the scale radius?
Yeah, that's the peak circle velocity, which applies to the scale radius.
Okay.
So that's actually, that's kind of a more physical measure for the size of the system. That's something that stays constant once the real mass addition is done.
So the concentration actually drops a tiny bit in each of those blips during the merger, and then goes back.
Yeah, it fluctuates somewhat during the direct relaxation, during the major mergers.
Can I check, you're defining mass within a spherical radius under 3 dC?
Yes.
So you have some decision to make about where to place the sphere.
Yeah, I put it around the main progenitor, the most massive progenitor.
Do you move it about to maximize the mass contained?
No. It's centered on the most massive progenitor, always the same one.
On occasion, the most massive progenitor changes.
Yes, I.
But it didn't happen.
I'm not changing it. I'm always using the main progenitor of the center in the end. So this is all defined as a subnatal. And it's always the one that has more than 50% of the particles. So I really follow the same four backwards in time.
I'm not at all objecting to the level line. It makes perfect physical sense because spherical symmetry is not a good approximation. But I guess there's a hazard that you're measuring the mass within the wrong place. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's centered the same way as the movie was centered. It's like this main.
All right.
The center.
We're
you have to trace the center back.
Okay.
It of course it moves around somewhat, by the large scale forces that accelerate it. Okay. Now compared to the self-similar secondary inflow model. So that starts out a similar way, and then one doesn't stop here, but one really follows the dynamics of these mass shells. So they go through the center and then back out to almost the turnaround radius and so on practically periodic orbits in these fixed coordinates. In coordinates relative to the current turnaround radius, they do something like this. They fall in, go through the center, and then go around this way. And this is also a snapshot, so at each time you have mass shells occupying each point on these lines. And of course, when you integrate the mass at a certain radius, you get this power law with the spikes, these infinite density spikes at these turnaround radii here, at these episodes. And so I want you to keep this pattern in mind. And it's also, you have to keep in mind that this is a growing scale. So this would be, in physical coordinates, this would be growing towards the right. And I want you to look for these kind of features in essentially in this panel. So that's orbits of subnatals. So this infall, and these sort of illustrate how subnatals move. It's just six ones that I've selected, these two, three orbits. I'll show it again. Now, if you split it up into how many orbits things have completed, it becomes a bit clearer. So in this panel, you clearly see this feature, and it moves the right way, it grows towards the right. And it also grows in amplitude as the velocity becomes bigger. Instead of subhalos, we can also plot that for the particles. It's essentially the same, but just for all the particles. For the beginning, there's major merging, it's messy. At the end, you see this broad infall, and then some kind of broad, some caustic-like branches here. Of course, the difference to the model is these things are very broadened. They're not lines anymore. So there's dispersion in the radial velocity. There's also dispersion of a similar amount in the tangential velocity. So not everything will go to the center. So it does not pile up at exactly the same radius. So these things are really washed out. So if you integrate that up, you don't get much of a density enhancement. So in the best case, in this example, the best example is the third caustic, which gives you about a 10% broad bump in the total density profile. It's very little. If you were able to just measure the mass that's at small radial velocity, then you can, of course, enhance that signal and you can recover that bump. That just means that these things are very hard to detect. So lensing or something that just measures mass is not going to see it because you're going to get actually larger disturbances from bound structures. So you need to have also the radial velocity information. So the only object where we can access that would be the stellar radial of the Milky Way. It's still extremely difficult to detect these things. And of course, forward. That also means that the radial velocity distribution at a given radius is very non-Gaussian. So if you look at it in the outer halo, you have this infalling peak and you have this first caustic peak at this radius. If you go further in, you always have that infalling and outgoing populations, which in this case are superpositions of things on a different numbers of orbits. At this radius, we hit the third caustic, so you have this middle peak at low velocities. And only if you go to the very inner halo, things become very normally distributed. So that's the Gaussian, the red. So that means the inner halo is smooth in this diagnostic. That, of course, does not include things like what Robin has been talking about in the faint fine-grained distribution. There are going to be streams and substructure. But in this global picture, the inner halo looks quite smooth.
So how big a box do you take to measure these in?
Here, I just use all the particles in 10 to 20 kiloparsecs and make a histogram of the radial velocity. Okay, so now we can look at the positions of all the things that have made an infall and then are now at the first pericenter. And then you get, for these objects, you get a median position of 453 kiloparsecs and the widespread in radii. And it's interesting to compare that with the turnaround radius these things have, which is 490. So they go up to 90% on average of their turnaround radius. And that's very close to what the secondary infall model predicted, which is 876. And the same is true for the second, third. And we've traced it up to the sixth, but these are very broad, so there's not much point. But on average, these always go up closely to their turnaround.
So this scale depends on the accretion rate, doesn't it?
It is.
You don't have a particular accretion rate in Lamar and Goldberg, right?
That's true for the outer halo. Uh-huh. And the model we compare to is to essentially the point mass, initial point mass perturbation. And if you have a more extended initial perturbation, these become smaller. And that's the response to the faster accretion. We see a bit of that in the inner halo, where in the inner halo we do see some significant collapse, but not near the video radius.
I mean, I'm just thinking naively, as you're going up to the first alpha-centric passage, if you dump a lot of mass at the halo, then it'll
accept it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think
yeah.
The quick means of the matter falling in is lighting up the cosmic, so the variable is fine.
So there should be. Some.
That's exactly. Yeah. That's, I mean, the a lot of the global mass distribution is established at redshift 1.7 in this object already when the major merging is done. And what's falling in afterwards is already near video equilibrium at turnaround. So it goes through a practically stationary mass distribution, it falls in, and so it has to fall out almost to the same scale again.
Oh, okay.
And that scale is for the first two parties at least, that scale is well beyond the real radius too. So that's why a lot of these things are on orbits that take it outside of the like usual definition of halo.
But your static mass here though seems to be like very small, right? I mean, really, you know. So you have infall actually that will really out to a very large radius.
Yes. You look at the density profile relative to the final one. Now it's pretty much established. Mm-hmm. So there's infall here, but it doesn't add much.
But set the loss dispersion of in the infall.
This?
Yeah. What does it depend on?
I think it's due to other structure that forms in the same region and on larger scales too. So there's proper motions induced by other structures that are
the
around.
Older structures, I assume, right? A smaller, older.
Smaller and larger. And there's some of it is due to the bound structure, like this spike, that's a big structure that's falling in. But then there's also the dispersion from the large scale tidal fields.
But you said 97% of the mass that falls in comes in bound structures, right? So everything is just a bound structure.
Yes.
So at least some fraction of that dispersion is just from that fact that because you're plugging in the particles, right?
Yes. So things that fall in large clumps have already a large internal velocity dispersion, but the larger part is due to smaller things that fall in with an external random motion, right? Proper motion back to.
But the list is
like 100 kilometers a second dispersion.
Yeah.
So it's a triaxial collapse, I assume, so there would be different velocities in different directions. So that isn't that true?
Yes, it's triaxial too. That's another difference to the. Okay. I'm almost through. So that's not my work. That's a very interesting paper that came out recently. I mean, it's well known that press Schachter mass function does not fit the simulated real mass functions very well. So, I mean that these mass functions assume that this collapse by factor 2 happens, and that we can find this mass within R200, which we've just seen is not true. This mass does not stay in there. But you can find it within a larger radius. And that's exactly what's been done in this paper. So instead of just measuring the mass within R200, they measure the mass that's associated to the halo, so even if it's beyond R200, all the mass that's in equilibrium. And that makes a difference, especially for galaxies, this mass scale. Not so much for the clusters. And then they find that press Schachter does actually a pretty good job in predicting the abundance of these systems, much better than Schett-Forman. Schett-Forman is a generalization that does not assume spherical, but elliptical. And of course, you then introduce three parameters that can be adjusted to fit the abundance in terms of M200 that you measure in simulation. But if you actually measure the true mass, you find a pretty good agreement with the simple press Schachter mass function. That just suggests that the problem with the original press Schachter was this factor of 2 collapse that people assumed. They assumed you'll find the mass within this small radius, but there's no reason to confine that confines the mass to this small radius.
I'm still puzzled about this.
And probably the spherical spherical symmetry, of course, is not, it's not spherical, but that doesn't seem to have been the problem in wide field.
So actually, if you get Kuhn-Hayer redshift, the formula will fail for the press circuit with the same definition.
So for static masses, you're saying this,
yeah.
this fails.
For that reason, yeah. For that, I know how I got the Hayer redshift result. It will fail for Hayer redshift. So it only works for redshift 0.
Yeah, they've only done that at redshift 0. So yeah.
But they now they have new code for Hayer redshift. They don't agree with the press check.
With the same counting all the diagnostics.
Yeah. I'm still, I don't know, maybe I should ask you afterwards, but I'm still puzzled with this collapse factor of 2 thing, because you figure out how much the thing would collapse by, which would be fine if that area didn't accrete any more mass. But then by the time the stuff's gone out to the virial radius and come back, that area's accreted more mass, so it is a different mass. So I was a little bit worried whether you weren't, I mean, is it not just that the mass of the halo has changed by the time the stuff's gone out and come back in?
But it's small radius, though, the mass isn't changing.
Because in the spherical infall model, it isn't a factor of 2, it's a factor of 0.8 times 2 or 0.9 times 2, which in effect is saying the same thing, right? That you've dumped more mass into the potential by the time you go back out and come back in, which is part of the reason you don't go out as far as you, right? I mean, you have some energy, you fall in, and then as you're trying to go back out, somebody's dumping mass into the center of the potential, so it slows you down. So that accounts for some of it,
No, that means it's exactly a factor of 2.
It's exactly a factor of 2. If you go to the next block, you flash through in Fillmore and Goldrush.
I mean, what happens is that the turnaround radius at that time is slightly larger than the turnaround radius of this shell. But in EDS, it's exactly a factor of 2. In along the CDM, it's slightly different.
But it's a factor of 2 relative to the mass at the time the thing fell in.
Yeah, and just relative to the turnaround radius of this shell. So when if this would be redshift 0, this would be the virial radius of this shell. And it would be half of the turnaround radius at slightly higher time. It's not the current turnaround radius. So that's why.
So your earlier plot is.
And that's where it's factored in, so that's why.
Okay, so your earlier plot is the turnaround radius as you would have calculated it originally when it first fell in. So.
I compare to the.
Let's bear in mind that under spherical symmetry, you have no kinetic energy when you reach 1. But under a vast departure from spherical symmetry, that thing can have a lot of kinetic energy when the mean radius has reached its maximum value. And that, of course, would suppress the recollapse, which I guess is what you're reporting that people are seeing.
Yes.
It's not a terribly great surprise.
Yes, what I'm saying is that at turnaround, the mass is already close to real equilibrium.
Because
it's going to go out there again.
Given the kinetic energy.
And that is, might not be surprising, but it's very different from what is the basis for these Vibeus definitions.
Yes.
So you think that's torque tests, like external torque tests?
Well, remember, it's vastly non-spherical. Didn't you mention a collapsing ellipsoid? It could be collapsing in one dimension while it's expanding in another.
Yeah.
And so when the nominal mean radius is maximum, it's got a lot of kinetic energy.
Yes. So just to summarize this, there's of course, these differences between the simple models tell you that these m vir and m 200 are not going to describe all the mass that's associated with the system. I mean, they are simple, in some cases useful definitions, but they should not be taken too seriously. They're not measuring the real physical mass. Also, that the typical orbits are really quite periodic, pretty regular, so they tend to go out close to their own turnaround radius again, on average. Of course, the spread is huge due to non-spherical symmetry, dispersion in the radial and tangential velocity, and so on. So that's why you don't get high density costs from the info at the things turn around. And Another thing is when you define field halos as everything that's beyond R200, then you, of course, have things that were subhalos of some kind that you now count as field halos. And their histories are now depending on environment, of course. Because in near big things, you have many of these supporting subhalos, and their assembly histories are completely different from true field halos that have never gone through a time MOSFET series. That's it.
Now I object that in the second to the last comment, you look for the caustic under the average, under the under a spherical averaging or a cylindrical averaging. No, spherical.
Spherical.
And if the thing is aspherical, that's not the place the caustic will show up.
That's correct.
But we did make that plot also for some kind of binning in ellipsoidal radius and ellipsoidal velocity.
How about simple cuts?
Yeah, like, could you have to, if you got something that has a finite angle to it,
you might have to see it if you made a cut.
Unless a statistic.
Well, you lose statistic.
So I think I would be more cautious in saying that you can't see these things with lensing, because people, I mean, the group of this lensing of Yannick Mellier, Bernard Ford, and Gavazzi, they've already looked at the Filmon-Goldberg model with the velocity dispersion, which is very high, and they said if you stack enough number of halos on top of each other, you could have a good signal-to-noise ratio, and you can see that in the lensing data.
We don't follow the same places.
And also in the SNAP and Loon data. So you need about 600. To just stack on top of each other to see that, and it's quite reasonable.
Yeah, it's, you have to stack them very accurately so that always the first cost
is stacked off on the same. Exactly, so it's the outer core space. They also took into account the intrinsic electricity of the lens. Mm-hmm. So if you have got enough of them, you can see the outer core space, because the separation from the outer core space is large, so you would not smear that completely.
Yeah.
So I would be more cautious in saying you can't see it because there's not enough mass, because it's actually projected density.
I mean, especially in clusters, they're like less relaxed than this early forming galaxy. You have larger substructures in the outer part. Even in this galaxy, I get bigger peaks in the spherical density profile from large substructures. Like these 10% peaks, you can get these easily from. I get this easily from subhalos at any position. So that noise is going to be difficult.
They have also considered the noises. You know. They've exactly calculated the number of the clusters that they have to stack on top of each other in order to have a signal noise ratio that would be good. And that reaches about 600.
Yeah, I've looked at their paper. They had a much smaller dispersion.
They have a huge dispersion. They are about 7 kilometers per second velocity dispersion.
Yeah, it's very small for clusters.
Yeah. But then you can increase it. I mean, but then
it would be much broader, I guess, in a realistic
sense. You can increase it, but then it would be larger. But for the outer core space, I would expect that to be the same. I mean, I don't know, but I think I would be more cautious. I would not just say it's too dark for length. I wouldn't make the strongest statement as you.
Yeah.
Not at this stage. Maybe with future simulations.
Well, it shows up in your movie.
Okay, so I think we can move on. Let's thank